Barbie.
Yes.
Not Barbie bowls, not bowels, not bowls.
Not boulet.
Bowls. Not boulet. Boulet. Boulet would be, boulet is fancy you. That's fancy you. Yeah.
I do that sometimes. I let people get away with that sometimes.
Yeah, that's like hold out your hand to be kissed by somebody. Like you're that's who that is. Yeah, totally.
That's right.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you today?
I'm good. It's been a long time since I had a guest on the podcast whom I've never interacted with in a podcast setting. I've had a couple of repeat guests on come on recently, and I've done a lot more solo episodes since my daughter's been born. Just, it's not that they don't take any prep. They sure as heck take some prep, but they take a little bit less prep. And so I'm excited to have you on.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Yeah. Why don't you do the classic podcast intro for people living under a rock who may not have interacted with you on social media. Who are you? What do you do? What are you passionate about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am Barbie Bowles. I'm a registered dietitian, have been for almost 25 years. I don't know. I lose count like we all do. And I have always been in private practice. I have always been focused on women's health, nutrition and lifestyle. And as I've aged and my clients have aged and we've gotten more into the midlife, area between the ages of 40 and 60, I've gotten more interested in the metabolic changes that happen, blood pressure, blood lipids, our glucose, our body composition. And so that's really my focus. And then when I realized maybe, I don't know, 10-ish years ago, that is really the foundation upon which the health of our brain rests, I started getting really interested in women's brain health. And then when I realized that nearly two-thirds of those affected by Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's patients are female, that just lit a fire in me. And so that has really become my mission. It is truly, honestly, to do everything I can in this lifetime to help women prevent Alzheimer's disease. And so that's what I talk about. And I always say this, but it's true. It sounds cliche at this point because I've said it a bazillion times, but my passion became purpose when my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 2022. And she lived with me for several years. I was her primary caregiver, and we just moved her into memory care this summer. So, I have lived up close and personal with this disease. I've been studying it for a long time. And so it's why I'm here in a professional way.
That's awesome. What part of that's awesome? What's awesome is purpose meeting passion. That's what you said, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they met, but I think most people have somebody in their life who's been affected by a neurodegenerative disease. And we're going to talk about Alzheimer's dementia today, but, I don't want to pretend like it's all the same and it's all a catch-all, but there are.
And you're right, though, because it is important to understand that everyone, with degrees of separation, whether it's you, whether it's a loved one, whether it's a friend, whether it's someone you will ultimately care for, we will all be affected by this disease. And the trajectory is not looking good. And that's partly why I want to do what I do, because I want to change that trajectory, particularly for women. I care about men too, but women are more affected. So.
Totally. Who do you work with directly? Are you working with people directly or just educating?
Yeah, I do see, well, I have always seen one-on-one clients. I also do corporate wellness programming. That said, I have kind of wound down both of those areas of my business to do more speaking and more writing. So I am on Substack and I do a lot of speaking all over the country. And I do still take the occasional private client if it's a perfect fit and we are really well aligned in what her goals are. And I do still take the occasional corporate wellness client if they're looking for a speaker to talk about specifically women's health and women's Alzheimer's prevention. I've just really kind of narrowed it down in the last year or so.
When you go speak corporate wellness, what are they coming for specifically brain health or women's health or a mix?
Well, so I started doing that about almost 10 years ago. And in the beginning, it was everything. Right. It was cooking classes. It was, cholesterol, it was heart health, it was all the things. Diabetes prevention. And now I really just have limited it to if you want to talk about women in the menopause transition and how to prevent metabolic illness and or neurodegenerative disease, I'm your gal. But I've just really kind of, I'm 55. I get to make the calls now.
Yeah, it's great. And you're going to do a better job if it's a thing that you're feeling particularly passionate about. And I didn't bring you on the podcast to talk about, paddle ball or something. Like I have you here to talk about the thing that you are feeling passionate about because you're going to do a great job at it.
Yeah, and I think early on, especially as, health, nutrition and fitness professionals, we kind of like maybe keep it very broad because we don't want to lose anybody. But then as we get older and we define our interests and we like have more conversations and we do more research, we niche it down, and that's where I am now. It really is for me, at the end of the day, it's about preventing Alzheimer's disease in women,
Awesome.
but men matter too.
Totally, totally, totally. Great. And we're going to get to that. Let's do a quick, I think the kids say roadmap these days. Nobody says table of contents anymore. I say roadmap. Roadmap's very hip right now, like to let people know like kind of what we're going to talk about.
I
So,
haven't heard that.
yeah,
I
it's
guess maybe
fancy,
I've
right?
been out of the corporate
It's
loop a little
good.
too long
Yeah, it's
now.
good. Roadmap. So, we're going to talk about some of the key drivers and causes. We'll talk about diagnosing Alzheimer's and early signs. We'll talk through risk factors, both modifiable and non-modifiable. We'll talk through some of the genetic stuff. We'll talk about medication and interventions. I will prod you to give a blurb on creatine that I will absolutely clip up out of context and blow up on social media. It'd be
Love
great.
it. Love it. You look like an asshole.
Yeah,
I love
totally, totally. We'll do. I. It's again. I'm sure being your mother's primary caregiver was incredibly tough. I will soak up all of that firsthand and have a discussion on caregiving and the family perspective, because that's also something that, again, I think, like you said, everybody will be affected by this. And then we'll go through some closing questions. That sound good?
Yeah, I love it. I
Yeah.
love it. And we can always put in notes anything we missed.
For sure.
Oh, no worries.
I had mentioned that it's also near and dear to my heart. Again, I think I say that, but I agree with you that everybody will be touched by this. But Alzheimer's runs in my family quite a bit. I'm an E4 homozygous, and so I'm fucked. And so no, I'm just kidding.
No.
Just joking. I'm joking. I'm joking. I'm joking. We're going to talk about what that is, by the way. And I have another podcast that I talked about that specifically, but we'll get to that in just a second. So let's do a bit of defining what Alzheimer's is and some of the key pathologies, drivers, causes. Basically, what are those causes and drivers, and what's actually happening?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I mean, if we're going to be really honest, we don't really know exactly what causes Alzheimer's disease. We have an ever-evolving list of risk factors that we can all address. And my favorite people in the space of Alzheimer's expertise really do say, if you have a brain, you're at risk. And so unfortunately, that's the truth. So causation, we're not quite sure, although we will talk about the risk factors. When it comes to what defines Alzheimer's, there are two main hallmarks, and first being the beta amyloid plaques that form. Beta amyloid being a normal plaque that exists in the brain, but when the pathology of Alzheimer's starts to occur, they start to accumulate, these proteins start to accumulate, and they form plaques outside of the neuron. So this is going to interfere with communication within the brain. And then secondly, we have tau, again, a very normal presence in the brain. But what will happen with tau in pathology is it will start to kind of collapse and form these tangles within the neuron, and that's going to cause neuronal death. So now we've got neuronal death, we've got poor communication, and this really strongly affects, at least initially, the hippocampus, which, to be very high level and way overly simplistic, is essentially the memory center or the new memory center of the brain. So this is the pathology that we see. And it's important to recognize that especially the beta amyloid accumulation and plaque formation, that or the beta amyloid accumulation, I should say, begins maybe 15, 20, maybe even a little bit longer years before any symptoms are demonstrated. So, you know, one of my heroes in this space is Dr. Lisa Moscone. She's a neuroscientist who is in the field of studying particularly women in midlife and hormones and menopause and its relationship with Alzheimer's disease. And what she says is this is really, Alzheimer's is really a disease of midlife that starts to show symptoms in older age.
Interesting. Is this something that this plaque buildup, the is this something that's happening to everyone, except we just die of different things at some point, and then or we are maybe it doesn't build up to a point in which it impacts our quality of life in some people by the time they die, and in others it's just happening earlier. Or is this something that is happening to some people and just isn't happening to others?
That's a really good question. And we would all have to MRI all of our brains or PET scan all of our brains to know the answer to that. But the accumulation is something that does seem to be a result of aging in addition to perhaps habits and risk factors, right? But this is part of why something that isn't talked about enough in terms of prevention, which is called co building cognitive reserve. This is the idea of never stop learning, always be, you know, just challenging your brain, treating your brain like a muscle, because it has been demonstrated in research with autopsied brains that there are people who, if you look at their brain, it looks like they have severe Alzheimer's disease. However, in life, they didn't behave that way. So it's difficult to answer that question directly, but what I would say is it's certainly true that there are some people for whom there is a lot of beta amyloid accumulation, there are a lot of tau tangles, there is a lot of like pathology happening, but their brains somehow navigate around it in a way that they don't behave that way in life. I just want to say real quick, little quick plug for sleep, because sleep, deep sleep in particular, is when we clear these beta amyloids. So sleep is crucial to Alzheimer's disease prevention. Just a little plug for that. But hopefully that answered your question. It's a little bit of a difficult one to like really answer super accurately.
Sure. And I think you said this already, but just to repeat it, is that I feel like this about gut health, where if you talk to people who know a little bit about gut health, they are super duper certain about leaky gut and, you know, this diagnosis and that diagnosis that are not real diagnoses. Well, we can get into that another time. But if you talk to real gut health experts, there's an air of humble, you know, hey, this is what we know. We don't know everything. And I sense that with you, and I appreciate that with you. And if you're a listener being like, hey, sounds like we don't, you know, she doesn't really know exactly what's going on. It's like that is the mark of a true expert
Good
in a field. Totally, totally.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that. It's true. Yeah, that is there's a lot we don't know. There's a lot we're discovering, and we just have to keep going with that.
One of the points that I made was, okay, so that might be true. And similarly to gut health, like you can say that, and in the next breath, still say with confidence, hey, we still know a lot of things to do to improve it, even if we don't know those very specific pathologies. You know, we have an idea, but and I come, and this isn't like a better or worse thing. I come very much from like, while I'm interested in the pathology stuff, I'm very interested in the what can we do about it, because it seems that we
Right.
know a bit more than about
That's what's
that.
important.
Totally,
Yeah.
totally, totally.
Yeah.
Let's what constitutes a diagnosis? I think this is a bit another kind of. Well, this exact question might be a bit vague, but we're going to talk about kind of where is that line between I'm getting older and my, you know, mild cognitive impairment and you know, what constitutes a diagnosis? What are the specific factors or thresholds that lead to an actual diagnosis? And then I won't give you too much. We'll start with that first.
Yeah. So it's a good question. It's very nuanced and it depends. Are you 55 or are you 85? Do you have type 2 diabetes and heart disease, or are you otherwise metabolically perfectly healthy and struggling with cognitive difficulty? The trajectory of what you experience in your primary care physician's office and then ultimately probably hopefully a neurologist's office are going to be a little different because your entire clinical picture needs to be taken into consideration, right? I will tell you, I will give you the story of my mother and how that, because it's very typical, right? She was 75. If I had been able to get her to a neurologist in 2019, she would have been diagnosed then. I was absolutely certain she had dementia. I wasn't sure what type. I suspected Alzheimer's, but I couldn't get her to the doctor until 2021. So I get her into her PCP. We get to a neurologist. I went to three neurologists before I was comfortable that this neurologist really had her best interests at heart. And this is my little plug also for self-advocacy. If you don't feel like you're being heard, if someone won't use the word dementia, if someone won't order an MRI, if someone won't order the testing that you're asking for, move on. Because that is your right. And as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to the doctor-patient relationship, they work for you. And you are doing an interview when you are seeing a doctor for the first time, and you're the one doing the hiring. So that's just my little side note on that. So we finally got with a neurologist I was comfortable with, ordered an MRI, neuropsychological testing. It was very clear based on the MRI that there were Alzheimer's type changes based on the neuropsychological testing, which is a 3-hour test. This is not just the 30-minute MoCA that's done in the doctor's office, where it's a full spectrum of domains for cognition and where the kind of gaps were for her. And sadly, by the time we got her there, it was too late. She was fairly advanced. So it was too late for some of the medications. It was too late for some of the therapies. So early intervention is key. And we'll get to kind of signs and symptoms. But when it comes to diagnosis, I've also seen clients had friends whose parents were diagnosed simply based on age, symptoms, and full clinical picture. No actual testing. And then you can go as far as lumbar punctures and PET scans. Fortunately, now we also have blood tests that we can talk about a little bit later. But the typical trajectory these days, especially with somebody who's in their 70s or 80s, is an MRI and a neuropsychological testing to identify where exactly the gaps in cognition are.
How does that change the things that that person should do? So you have two people who have symptoms that sound similar, similar age, and they sound similar because it's not like you've listened to way more people describe how they're feeling cognitively than I have, but I'm imagining that sometimes it can be a bit vague trying to describe exactly, where is the line between normal bit of forgetfulness and brain, a little bit of brain fog, and, a more serious clinical diagnosis. How important is it to you that somebody gets imaging done for what sort of intervention and medication, medication or lifestyle intervention that they should get themselves or start doing?
So it depends on, I would say, draw the line at, are your symptoms interfering with your daily life? So, is this preventing you from living your life the way you normally would? Or are you just kind of like leaving your keys in a weird place, or you don't really remember where your phone is, but you ultimately find it, or you're having trouble finding words, but you ultimately come up with it? The line is really drawn at, is this interfering with your work, your ability to manage your finances, your relationships, your ability to get places, that's where the line should be drawn, in my opinion. We can get more specific because I certainly think it is important, especially for my population, women in midlife, where brain fog is incredibly common, because some of the same, glucose regulation changes in the menopause transition too. And that is part of what we assume might be causative for this brain fog feeling that a lot of us have. And a lot of us get scared. Like, is this the beginnings of MCI or dementia? But really, I think that, I think you should go to your doctor if you're concerned, period, because what harm can be done, right? Go to your doctor, ask for an in-office cognitive test. It's 5 minutes to 30 minutes, depending upon which one they want. And if they're seeing something like, hey, maybe I should refer you to a neurologist, or maybe we should discuss this further.
What would they see?
So there are a few different little exams that they can do in your primary care office. One of them is sort of like called the clock exam. You have to draw a ton. They say, okay, here is an analog clock, right? Like you have to draw 10 minutes to 11.
For the young children, that is what the circular clock with the hand, the
two
the
one
hands,
on the wall.
Not the one on your phone, you know, the one on the wall. It's okay. Just want to make sure there's some people under 30 who've never seen one of those. So yeah, gotcha.
Right. Or draw a box or draw or identify an animal or things that seem really simple. But I will also say something. I've had many clients where anxiety is an issue for them, which can also crop up in midlife. And the second somebody asks you to draw 10 to 11, and
totally.
You're in the doctor's office and you're being evaluated for potential cognitive decline, and you're like freaked out, like, what's 10 to 11? I haven't seen that in a million years on an analog clock.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, all I would say is if you are concerned, you should always self-advocate and you should always get into your doctor's office and see what's going on. But I think probably the biggest factor is if your loved ones or colleagues or friends are saying to you, hey, are you okay? Because I kind of notice something might be up with you, or you don't quite seem totally there, or I'm concerned, then absolutely get to your doctor. Because oftentimes it's not the person with the cognitive decline who notices. And there's also a lot of denial that happens, right? So if loved ones are saying to you, I noticed a difference, I think it might be time to, you know, have that checked out, get it checked out. No harm done.
Yeah,
right.
Super helpful. It's like,
did that answer your question?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm going to prod a bit more, but the thing you said about the anxiety, it's similar to like a white coat hypertension. You know, you're like, get in the office, all of a sudden you have hypertension. You're like, this just happens when I'm here.
Right.
A question about the tests. And again, you can stop me if we're going too deep on this one thing, but I'm curious what somebody designs these tests on purpose, right? To test a specific-ish thing. What is that specific-ish thing? You know, I'm putting the clock. I'm asking you to do a task that's, you know, requiring a certain part of the brain to work hard, and that's the part of brain I'm interested in? Or what is it, a spatial exam, memory exam? Like what sorts of tests and for what purpose?
Well, it kind of covers all of that. I mean, depending upon which, you know, in-office cognitive tests you do, but they tend to cover that spectrum. Like not all of the domains, like a neuropsychological exam would test, but, and certainly not that depth, but just as sort of like little overview, like how we do it, you know, in ways that might be missed. And this may or may not be 100% true, but it has been reported that women fake this better than men. Because we, and I know some people might get mad at me for this, but women tend to be slightly better at communicating or kind of compensating for any deficit that we might be feeling. We find the word, we force ourselves to sort of find the words and kind of compensate for the situation. And that is not entirely scientifically or evidence-based, but it is something that a lot of my neurologist friends talk about, that oftentimes women have a better, an easier time faking it than men. Wow, we can apply that to a lot of things. never mind. So anyway, I would say that it is important to... make sure if you have any of your own concerns to get into your doctor's office. It's not going to be this full examination that's going to tell you everything, but it will hopefully lead a good doctor in the direction of, let's send you to a neurologist to do a little more work and do a little bit more deeper testing.
Cool. That's super interesting. Super interesting. You mentioned a couple minutes ago about some of the glucose uptake in the brain mediated brain fog, and there's chatter, and I'm going to ask you how legitimate, about, oh, we're renaming Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes. Talk me through type 3 diabetes. Strikes me as a term being used in a way and by people who tend to extrapolate on partial truths and, you know, run with them. And so is that what's happening with this kind of denomination of calling the Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes? Are there any shreds of truth? And just talk me through where that's come from.
Sure. So very much so. If someone is referring to Alzheimer's disease as type 3 diabetes, proceed with caution, because that is a pretty clickbaity way of referring to a very complex disease. It's really reductive. It comes from the fact that it is observed that in a brain that is affected by Alzheimer's, there is a reduction in the ability to properly metabolize glucose. I guess you could call it insulin resistance within the brain. But this is an entirely separate system from the rest of the body. So to refer to Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes is not appreciating the complexity, the full pathology of the way this disease works. It's one feature of the disease. And also, it implies that much like when people blame type 2 diabetes on carbohydrates or excess sugar consumption, which is inaccurate, or not the full picture, I should say, it has that implication. And then people are talking about you're eating too much sugar and you're having too much refined carbohydrates, and that's causing Alzheimer's disease, which couldn't, no. So no, again, this is a red flag of somebody who really doesn't understand the disease pathology and just like scroll on.
So carnivore diet's not going to fix my cognitive impairment. Okay.
No, and it's just an unfortunate, like, it was sort of a nickname that researchers, because it sort of made sense based on what they were seeing, but they in no way meant for that to translate into the language that was used in reference to Alzheimer's disease.
Gotcha.
Way more complex.
Totally. Super duper helpful. Super helpful. Let's turn our attention to non-modifiable risk factors, which is fancy for can't really do anything about this stuff. Would love to talk about what those are.
Yeah. So age, being female, you're at higher risk. There are a few genes. So there are some deterministic genes for Alzheimer's disease. The ones that are best studied, there are three. There's PSEN1, PSEN2, and APP. These are genes that tend to cause early Alzheimer's, so before the age of 65. If you have these genes in your, you would see it in your family. So, unfortunately, these are genes that are probably going to lead to Alzheimer's disease. Then there's APOE4. We all carry, I don't know how far you want me to get into this. I will say this, you can edit it. we all carry APOE, right? The APOE gene. And then there are three alleles. So there's APOE2, there's APOE3, and there's APOE4. APOE2, it appears to be somewhat protective. APOE3 appears to be neutral. And then APOE4 is considered a risk gene as opposed to a deterministic gene. So you inherit one copy of APOE from each parent. So there are six different combinations. You can all do the math there. And if you have one copy of APOE4, it appears that you have about a 2 to 3 times increased risk of Alzheimer's disease compared to somebody who doesn't carry APOE4. And if you carry two copies, you have about an 8 to 12 times risk of someone who doesn't carry APOE4. Okay. So in no way does it mean if you carry APOE4 that you will get Alzheimer's disease. Plenty of people who carry APOE4 never develop the disease. Plenty of people who don't carry APOE4 do develop the disease. So there we are. For example, my mother does not carry APOE4.
Yep. And I mentioned earlier, I have two copies of APOE4 and had learned that close to a decade ago and didn't really get a full picture of what it was. And again, we'll get to a follow-up question in a second of like, should people go out and get this information?
Because it is interesting because there are things that you as someone who carries APOE4, there are things that as far as we know right now, and I'm sure we'll know a lot more in the future, there are certain things that you want to pay attention to.
Absolutely, for sure. What's the prevalence of single E4 carriers or double E4 carriers in the population?
So I believe it's about, 25% one and like 3% two. Is that accurate?
I think it's 1 to 2% are homozygous. Homozygous get fancy for having two of them. So I think 1 to 2% have two of them. I don't know how many have one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, a 3-3 or ApoE3 is the most common.
Yep.
And ApoE2 is not very common at all. So yeah, I said 3%. So 1 to 2% is probably more accurate. You would know because you have probably done the research.
So we each get two copies of this gene, one from mom, one from dad. The combination of the two of them presents a certain risk profile. Sure. You know, E4 having one of them is not great. Having two of them is the worst of the bunch. But again, I'm not fatalistic about it. But let's just say in ranking from what you'd not want, that would be the worst. What do you think about, you know, I was listening to a podcast. Gosh, nothing good follows from that beginning sentence ever. I was listening to a podcast about one that I would say is putting out solid information. And two people were having a discussion around whether or not people should get this information, right? It's a non-modifiable risk factor. You can't do anything about it, about this one thing. What do you think about that? The idea that people are that this would be stress inducing, that this would be a net negative versus the idea of like, oh, this would be empowering. This would make you more likely to lean into what we'll talk about next, which is the modifiable side of things. What do you think about that?
Such a good question and so important to consider your unique perspective on this. I look at this a lot like I look at LP little a. So again, these are two things you can't do really much about. These are genetically influenced. If you are someone who is going to take this information and say, okay, let me figure out what I can do about this. Let me do all the things so that I can protect myself. And I feel empowered knowing this. And I feel good that I know this. Then the test is for you. If you are someone who would crawl under their bed and never want to come out and not want to do anything or touch anything or speak to anyone ever again because you're so anxious, then it's not for you. And you're probably not going to be harmed, you know, by not knowing the information. And I would just say, if you're somebody who feels so anxious that you don't want to have the data, treat yourself as if you have it and just do all the things. Does that make sense?
No, it makes total sense. The goal is to do the things we're about to talk about in a second. And if having the information you think would help you do those things, get the information. If you think getting that information would not prevent you from, but would pose some sort of emotional obstacle for you feeling super motivated to getting stuck into these things, then maybe that's not the best plan. The goal is to do these things, whether whether you have that information or not.
Yes. And it is really important to acknowledge that stress is a risk factor. Stress, depression, anxiety are all risk factors for brain health. Or we want to minimize these to protect the health of our brain. And if you are someone who would genuinely just not deal with that very well, then it's not for you. But then just do all the things accordingly and just be extra diligent about them.
If somebody wants to get that information, how can they get it?
Through your doctor. These tests are easily available now. Unfortunately, there are still some physicians who won't do it, you know, because it's not necessarily covered by insurance if there isn't a family history and so on. I've seen the ApoE test cost anywhere from $10 to $500. So look around if you're paying out of pocket. You can very likely find this test at an affordable, accessible price. That said, this is not a test I would do direct to consumer. I would want to go to a lab, have my blood drawn, and have it interpreted by someone who actually knows how to interpret these results and give me the right, you know.
What do you mean direct to consumer?
You can order, you can do a kit that comes to your home.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And you can do that. I would not recommend that for a genetic test. I would have your doctor, ideally you're having your doctor order it. You go to a lab, you have your blood drawn out of your vein in your arm and you know, it's properly handled.
Not to sound ignorant here, but what would an at-home kit be doing? How would they be, giving my blood by my own accord? Like,
yeah, you would do a finger prick and do a blood spot, or sometimes you have to squeeze blood from your finger into the tube, and there's just a lot that can go wrong.
Totally,
there, you know,
totally, it's a terrible idea. Sounds okay. I don't want to. If anybody's listening, they've done it and had success, and it's worked out fine, no problem. But sounds like a terrible plan. Yes. Yeah,
right. Yeah. No, for something like this,
sure.
No, for a B12 test something that, you know, may or may not like, but no, for something like ApoE4, or LP little a, or something like that, don't do direct consumer. Yeah.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Yep. Anything else on the ApoE stuff before we move on?
Well, only that if you are a carrier, first of all, ApoE4 has a more significant impact, it appears, on females than males. So if you, especially if you're a female ApoE4 carrier, exercise, incredibly important. Doesn't matter what it is, just move your body. Just make sure you are staying, your cardiorespiratory fitness, your strength training, you're getting it all in. ApoE4 carriers need to be especially careful about their LDL cholesterol or really ApoB. So you want to get that like into the 70s, 70 milligrams per deciliter. And omega-3, EPA and DHA. You may not utilize EPA and DHA as well as somebody who doesn't carry ApoE4. So you want to be sure as a dietitian, I need to say, check with your doctor to make sure that there are no contraindications for taking a DHA and EPA supplement, but you want to be sure you're getting plenty of omega-3 fatty acids.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Anything on that, carrying on from that thought, any other things on what ApoE4 is doing that's so bad?
Yeah. Well, it's not, it's bad, right? But it affects the way your brain uses lipids. So this is why making sure your LDL cholesterol is in good shape, or really your ApoB, and you're getting enough omega-3s. So it really, it's a gene that it helps your body utilize lipids.
Cool. I think that's well said and sufficiently deep. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
ApoB at 48, just saying, how we doing? Just saying. Yeah. No, I'm very proud of that. That's been a...
Is that with Medicaid? Sorry, that's HIPAA.
Yeah, it's not, but I would be, again, HIPAA, all this, but I'd be open to that. And I had first thought of getting it under 70, like we talked about and like you had mentioned. And yeah, high ApoB runs in my family. My dad is on a low dose Lipitor and just did everything lifestyle that we're going to talk about. And both of his parents had Alzheimer's and was unable to get ApoB where we wanted it. But with some medication, he's rock solid. It's been awesome.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Sweet. Sweet. Let's talk about, thank you. Let's talk about modifiable risk factors. This is a fun stuff. This is stuff you can do something about. Where would you like to start? You want to talk about the Lancet? Do you want to give your own list? Go ahead.
Yeah. So, we should start with the science. So the Lancet Commission every few years publishes a report on dementia prevention, intervention, and care. And the most recent one is 2024. And they sort of divide it by life stage. So there's early life, midlife, and later life. And early life thus far has really only included, the way they phrase it is less education being a risk factor. But to me, what this means is, access to early childhood development, skills, education, and so on. And often people will say, well, how is that modifiable? I mean, interestingly, with a lot of the Lancet risk factors, a lot of people will say, well, how is that a modifiable thing? And of course, we can't go back and change our early childhood education, but we can do what I was talking about earlier, which is building cognitive reserve. We can use our brain like a muscle and we can keep learning as we age. So there's that. But that's pretty high at 5% of there are 14 risk factors now, according to Lancet Commission. There are two new ones in this most recent report, and we'll talk about what those are. But what they total is about a 45% potential reduction. So in other words, if we could get all 14 of these risk factors under control, we could potentially reduce global dementia. This is not just Alzheimer's. This is all-cause dementia by 45%, which is almost half, which is pretty incredible. So less education. Interestingly, again, hearing loss. People will say, well, how is this modifiable? Hearing aids, making sure you go to the audiologist, especially as you get older. If somebody is saying to you, hey, I'm calling from you from the to you from the other room for like 10 minutes, go get your hearing checked, use your hearing aids. I know nobody wants to do that, but the technology is awesome now. Just this last year, what was added. And I don't want to say I was happy to see it added, but I was relieved to see it added, was elevated LDL cholesterol. We need to get this under control, and we need to stop talking about how high LDL, like people with high LDL don't get Alzheimer's, and we need to eat more saturated fat and dietary cholesterol. Please stop. Elevated LDL cholesterol is a significant risk factor for Alzheimer's, for dementia. In fact, it is tied with hearing loss at the top of the list at 7%. Then there is chronic depression. And some people worry, like, well, what about antidepressants? Isn't there a little bit of risk? This is a conversation for you and your doctor to determine, and which antidepressant, what's appropriate for you, what's the lowest dose you can be on, and because treating depression is incredibly important. So that's something you have to weigh with your prescribing physician. Brain injury, wear a helmet, wear a seatbelt, maybe don't play really, sports that might, threaten the health of your brain. Hypertension, this is something, because it's silent and we don't necessarily know, I mean, like LDL cholesterol, we don't know when it's elevated. We don't know when our blood pressure is high. We have to stay on top of our blood pressure, especially in midlife when it can rise. I recommend everybody over the age of maybe 35, but definitely 40, have a home blood pressure cuff and do it every once in a while because, white coat hypertension is a thing. And by the way, that's not something that should be ignored. Like, we shouldn't say, oh, just because it's high in the doctor's office, that don't worry about it. Like, that is something that should be paid attention to, but definitely high blood pressure. Being sedentary, we got to move our bodies. Whatever that looks like for you, it doesn't matter. It can be a walk, it can be really intense, whatever works. Don't smoke, don't drink to excess. obesity, type 2 diabetes. And then later in life, social isolation. So being lonely. So social connection is incredibly important. Air pollution, interestingly, again, doesn't feel like something that we can control. But depends on where we live and, in-home air purifiers to the degree to which they work, I don't know, but air pollution is a factor. And then vision loss. So same thing as hearing loss. If you get glasses, get contacts, get your eyes checked annually for sure, especially in midlife, because boy, oh boy, in midlife for women, the menopause transition, I mean, like, my vision is insanely bad. And then it took like 3 years to happen. So make sure you're checking out all those things. Is that
Yeah.
too much?
No, that's great. Then that's it's not too much. That's what they are. Those are the modifiable risk factors. The vision loss one is so the first time I saw this graphic that I know you're not reading off the graphic, but there is a very neat, convenient graphic for those interested. I'll put it in the show notes that puts it into like early life, midlife, later life, and has the percentages and all that stuff. It's very nice and neat. First time I was introduced to this graphic, the one that jumped off the page to me was the vision loss. And that, again, that you mentioned that's you emphasized that one too, but that's one that I have been putting off. Not that we need to talk about me, but that's one that I'm like, okay, that's one I've really been kicking the can down the road with and not taking care of. And
You're wearing glasses.
I'm wearing glasses. I have a really bad astigmatism in my left eye that I can't. And one of the things that's funny that I'm going to reach with what I'm about to say, but some of these things like social isolation, like hearing loss, a lot of, they are intertwined a bit, like spending time with people, and I think making eye contact with others and hearing others and being around others. I struggle with making eye contact with people in real life at close range for long periods. Like if we go out to dinner or something like that, I can't do it. My eye starts to like shake and it's really struggling. So that's something I need to take care of. But that was something that personally for me has been, I think today I took a couple of notes. I was like, all right, we need to go back to the optometrist or whatever and take care of this. But you know what it is? It's astigmatism. Sorry, I'm an event. One of my good friends down the road she's an optometrist, and we were just talking about this.
Do it.
Astigmatism. Can we figure this out, people? Like, if you, I just, it's not like I can just get LASIK. You know what they told me is to do eye physical therapy. I have to go in to do physical therapy for my eyes like 3 times a week, and I'm like, man, in a world with like pills and potions and shots and procedures, you guys can't hook me up with something? I have to do like workouts for my eyes. So I do think that seeing this on that list has been just something where I'm like, all right, this can't just go on forever. But yeah.
Right. Well, okay. So let me kind of, that sounded like a lot and it sounded like kind of all over the place, right? But here's the way to look at it. There are two main themes here. One is vascular health, and the other is brain stimulation. So if you look at all of those risk factors, you'll see those two themes in all of them, right? Or not the two themes in each of them, but you overall, that's what's happening. So far as we know, the two most important things, the easiest way to look at it is to protect the vasculature of your body, and your blood-brain barrier is highly vascularized. So you want to protect those little blood vessels that supply your brain with all the good stuff, and don't let the bad stuff in and don't let the good stuff out. And then also, again, I've said it now, this is the third time, I think, using your brain like a muscle. So something like vision and something like hearing, if you don't see well and if you don't hear well, you're not going to communicate as well. You might not be as interested in socializing. You might not be as interested in learning new things, you know? So it all kind of, it makes sense when you look at it that way,
No,
in
I
my
think that's
opinion.
wonderfully put. I think that was the words I was searching for, was they fall under the brain stimulation category, either directly or indirectly, for sure, for sure. Interestingly, that LDL just snuck its way onto this list, also at the highest percentage. What was holding it back for so long, and what was a straw that broke the camel's back to get it on here?
You know, I don't personally know the answer to that. I have been looking for that on this list for a long time because it's pretty clear. I mean, we know, like I was saying, about vasculature and diabetes has been there. So why not elevated LDL cholesterol? And I can't personally answer the question about what was holding it back. Maybe, you know what, I'm not even going to venture a guess. That would take us down a trajectory. I have thoughts, but let's not go there. The point is, it's there now, and it has deserved to be there for some time. And now we recently, you know, under 100 milligrams per deciliter is where we want to be with low risk. Under 70 milligrams per deciliter is where we want to be for Alzheimer's prevention or with some degree of risk, like elevated Lp(a), type 2 diabetes, or diabetes, I should say, family history. And then under 55 milligrams per deciliter if you've had an event already, like a heart attack or a stroke. But yeah, in my opinion, it's deserved to be there for some time. I'm just glad it finally is, and I can't really answer the question about why it hasn't been.
Yeah. I'm glad it's there now.
Yeah.
I feel like a listener of this podcast is probably familiar with the type of advice you'd get if you were trying to be generally healthy, right? It's like probably my entire shtick is here, you know, even just today's post on social media of like listing the big rocks for improving general health. And when we do that, we can look at some of these things: physical activity, hypertension, obesity, LDL cholesterol. And I'm not saying that those are all just fixed with the general big rocks advice for everybody all the way, but those I feel like are things people are familiar with. High blood pressure, high LDL. I got to move my body. I have to, you know, take care of my body composition. The brain stimulation and cognitive reserve is, I think, the thing that is most ambiguous, and probably, you know, what, even if most people aren't taking care of their physical health as well as I think we could as a country, from a population standpoint, and that sounds like it's a personal responsibility side of things, but let's just say from a physical health perspective, I think, you know, whatever, you know what I mean. This feels a bit vague, like a thing that people, not vague, like you don't understand what it is to challenge your brain, but something that people aren't. I feel like we're fighting battles on inactivity. We got to work out. I got to get my vegetables. I got to get my fiber. I got to do this. And now it's like, well, I actually also got to like go, you know, do new
Learn
things.
something.
Go learn something. Go learn a language. Try a new activity. Do something mentally stimulating. So could we spend a little time on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is one of the most underappreciated and under-discussed areas of, you know, maintaining good brain health and preventing neurodegenerative disease. So it doesn't have to be overly complicated. It really is just thinking, as I've said before, I'm going to say it again, thinking of your brain like a muscle is, in my opinion, the easiest way to think about it. How can I, without stressing myself out, we don't want to stress, but how can I create some eustress, you know, that positive form of stress for my brain on a regular basis. It doesn't have to be daily. Maybe I take a twice a week class where I learn painting or sculpture or maybe a new language. That's pretty much classic, but not everybody is interested in that. But even on a smaller level, getting somewhere without a GPS, you know, trying to remember people's phone numbers. And brain games, like online brain games, are fine, but really all they do is get you really like skilled at a particular kind of thing, which isn't necessarily going to translate into better brain health. But how can I expand what I'm doing on a daily basis to just stimulate my brain in a way that is ultimately going to open up my world to better experiences, to better learning, to better connection? One of the best ways to go about it, honestly, is to take a class with friends. So you're learning something new, especially if it's something tactile, like a cooking class or an art class. So now you've got the hand, the, you know, the motor skills connection, you're being social. Let's not add alcohol into the situation. But you know, now we're killing three birds with one stone. We're learning something new, we're being social, and we've got motor coordination. These are all amazing things. You know, something else that's become sort of popular is exercise where you're with a friend and you're doing something that, like, say you're tossing a medicine ball back and forth and you're doing math equations at the same time, or you're doing, like, you're continuing a story. You know what I mean? And you're alternating sentences. You know, just every opportunity you can, use your brain the way it's meant to be used. It's not meant to be used but just looking at a screen and scrolling. It's not meant to be used like just sitting on a couch with Netflix and popcorn. Although that's super fun and we all do it. Like, take every opportunity you can to be a little bit more expansive in the way that you think about how you're using this. This is who you are. This thing inside your head is your personality. It's everything about your life. It needs more attention than I think we give it.
I don't want to do that with this count, with that count, with this count, but on a couple of things that come to mind, like reading. Could reading count? Could learning about a new topic count?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I think that's something that, like, as a mother of a 22-year-old and an 18-year-old, I see how reading is becoming a lost skill, you know, and it makes me sad because this is how we learn vocabulary. This is how we learn language. And this is how we learn to really be articulate and know stories and references. And yes, absolutely. Reading is a beautiful way to increase the cognitive reserve of your brain. And just to be clear, cognitive reserve is not necessarily something that prevents neuropathology or disease. What it does is it helps strengthen the synapses that you have so it can navigate around potential pathology. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I want to say, if you're listening to this and you have something in your life that comes to mind that you do, that's awesome. That's incredible. So I'm going to ask a couple follow-up questions, but it's almost like going deep into the nuances of exercise, but I'd like to preface, if someone's listening and they're exercising at all, it's amazing. And so what I want to ask is, do you think that there's a novelty component or a difficulty component? What I mean by that is my family, we speak Dutch, and I say we speak Dutch.
That's so unusual. That's really
cool. I can speak maybe 75% fluently, let's say. And I realized that I'm going to be the last person to speak unless I teach my daughter. And I don't think I'm going to teach my daughter, just for whatever reason. But I was like, hey, like, I'd like to sharpen my tools with that as a way of it checking that box for me, but also as a thing to communicate with my family and have some fun with it. That is, to me, like, I'd say that, and, you know, some of my work, which I find intellectually stimulating, but outside of work, that is my one thing that comes to mind for me. However, it's one thing and it's the same thing, lighting up the same parts of my brain per se, but it gets more challenging and more challenging and more challenging. So that would be, I'd say, something that's not novel, but it's going deeper and deeper and becoming more challenging and more challenging versus, like, you know, having a once a week class where I do something completely new every single time. Do you see there to be a nuanced difference between those, or do you put them in the same bucket of like, hey, dude, you're doing something that's awesome?
Yeah. So I will always be the person to say you're doing something that's awesome. Like, I believe that in every facet of your life. And it's difficult to say at this stage what is like, what really makes the difference and in whom, right? But what I would definitely say is important is complexity, because you want to be making your brain connect dots all over the place, different regions, right? Using as much of your brain, I mean, that's really overly simplistic, but you know, you get what I'm saying. Using as many different regions of your brain and making them connect and making them communicate as possible. This is why I was saying taking a class with friends and doing something tactile, like you're in, or, you know, dance, like with friends, you know, you're engaging so many different, you said no.
No,
I would say no to that too. But you know, it actually, dance is actually really awesome.
I'm already too good at dancing is what it, no, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. Oh, which wouldn't be challenging. No, I'm just joking. I'm kidding.
Yeah, but no, but like, for example, with language, with Dutch, which is incredibly unusual in the United States. So that's really cool. You know, and I encourage you to teach your daughter, because the act of teaching is incredibly, that recruits a lot of regions of your brain, right? I mean, it's your own memory. It's your ability to be patient. It's your ability to explain something and articulate. I mean, that teaching is an incredible form of building cognitive reserve. So is that helpful?
No, super duper helpful, super helpful. And I think you're right, where I struggle to get worked up beyond the point of, when we have this conversation, I hope it motivates somebody to find something in their life that sounds like this. It's like, it's just, I can't get too worked up about the uber micro nuances of certain like training methodologies when so many people don't exercise at all. And so, you know, it's not that there might not be some nuances somewhere, but it's like, hey, like, you'll know it when you see it, if you're doing something new, novel, cognitively demanding, etc.
100%. You know what, like, a few of my favorite examples are somebody who doesn't cook at all, but has an interest, learning to cook, getting in their kitchen and starting to understand recipes, understand maybe even diving a little deeper into food science and, you know, producing meals. I mean, like, that is like, you're working your body, you're working your hands, you're working your mind, you're learning. Somebody who kind of has a sort of side interest in plants or gardening or having a garden, but really learning about botany and really building a garden and, you know, producing something different every year. Like, these are the kinds of things I'm talking about.
I love that.
Got a little something like that, right?
Totally. Get a little nerdy about your hobby, you know?
Yeah, totally. Or cars, you know, if you want to learn how to, you know, save some money and learn how to, like,
learn how to drive. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, they should do that.
You know, no, just kidding. How to change an outlet, or, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, stuff like that.
Yeah, I really love that. And again, I what I led off with was that is just definitively separate from, I got what, you know, what feels like the daily slog of, I got to exercise and get my veggies and get my protein. It's like taking care of your brain as a muscle is, you know, you want to age physically well, but I'm currently more afraid of losing my cognition than I am of like, hey, listen, I want it all. We all want it all. But that's definitely on my mind a lot of, you know, if I don't have my physical health, okay, that's really bad too. If I don't have my cognitive health, that's really bad too. And so I better be doing something. I have something in my life that checks that box.
Yeah. I mean, you know, especially, and obviously I mostly speak to women, but, you know, I what I'm so proud of about my generation of women is that we really are starting to fully reject the messaging of our youth, which was just like, be rail thin, all about aerobics, forget about strength. Like, I don't even remember anybody ever talking about strength or strength training, but we're starting to reject that. And we're about strong over skinny, which is incredible, which is amazing. But if we really want to age well, we also have to think about our cognitive fitness. And I think this is kind of what you're alluding to there.
Yeah. What's cool is though, like, is you don't need to do any of this. You don't have to exercise. You don't have to have brain stimulation. If you just take enough creatine. If you just take enough creatine and it crosses the blood-brain barrier, which, if you say blood-brain barrier, you are definitively an expert on the topic, you're good. And so could you validate that for me, please?
Oh, boy. So here's what I'll say, just like in a nutshell, we're not there yet. in terms of, there's some promise. It's interesting. There was a recent study that had made a big splash, but it was tiny, and it wasn't really the kind of creatine. It wasn't creatine monohydrate, which is what most people take. So we're just not there in terms of like take 5 grams of creatine a day and you're gonna think better. Like that's not where we are. So take it if it's working for you for your workouts and you're finding benefit there. But in terms of cognition, just hang in there. The research is underway.
Yeah, I've taken the position lately of like, it doesn't seem like there's a downside. The funny thing is the downside, what creatine used to be mega cheap. And so it used to be this thing of like, hey, like throw it on the pile of other stuff that you do, and it might do a little bit here, it might do a little bit there. Maybe there's some cognition, we don't really know. It can add, you can get another rep here and there, and so there's a little bit of strength and hypertrophy available to you. But it's mostly one of those things that probably doesn't do much, but also doesn't cost much. And so a large net positive because it doesn't cost much. But now if we're looking at like, I know there was a recent research in perimenopause that didn't use a lot of creatine, but the type of creatine dosing that we're talking about to cross the blood-brain barrier, which does not automatically mean it's some panacea, some savior of cognitive health, is like 20 grams a day.
Right.
20 grams a day. Now we are no longer talking about this like mega cheap thing that you just throw on the pile. It's still not crazy expensive, but now it's wow, it's a if it doesn't do anything and I got to take 20 grams a day, that sure is an investment here. So I did chuckle at that because it used to wear the badge of honor of like mega cheap, super well researched, might do something, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, as we know, also just side note, which I'm sure you talk about all the time, strength training is what matters. So the creatine on its own or the protein on its own, but like we got to be strength training for it to make a difference anyway. But in terms of cognition, I am keeping my eye on the research. I'm hopeful. I mean, and something else to understand that often gets conflated is that there's a difference between a healthy brain and an Alzheimer's brain. Right. So sometimes something that we may be interested in for an Alzheimer's brain, like something veering towards more of a ketogenic diet or something like creatine or certain supplements that may show some promise in someone who already has that neuropathology, doesn't necessarily translate to a healthy brain for prevention. Does that make
No, it
sense?
makes a ton of sense and is not intuitive, I think. And that's why I think that that is mi often misunderstood of like, oh, here's something that is really great for people who have full-blown type 2 diabetes and I'm a regular healthy person. It's like, it doesn't, I get how somebody can come to the conclusion of like, oh, if it works for someone who's further down the line, it'll work for me who's, not as far down the line. So I see that. If I'm somebody, I'm 45, perimenopausal woman who's looking for any help she can get, here sees this pilot study come out, this recent perimenopausal study in creatine come out, and says, hey, I have not taken creatine. Should I? What would you say?
I would say if you're not strength training, no. Yet,
If they
like,
are strength
no.
training.
If you are strength training, then maybe it can improve or benefit your workouts. I think that that's something that I have always asked my clients to be a bit intuitive about. Like, take it before, take it after, experiment. Let's see, like, is it doing something for you? Because I have always been extremely conservative and judicious when it comes to supplementation. I want to know it's actually doing something if somebody's going to spend some money. So sometimes we know that through blood work. Sometimes we just know that in terms of how we feel. But when it comes to creatine, again, like you said, it's extremely well researched for its safety, 3 to 5 grams. Okay. And if you think it's doing something, awesome. For cognition, I'm not going to say it is going to improve cognition yet. Now, some people do take it for jet lag and do see an improvement. What it seems to be most, where the evidence seems to be the strongest, is in a compromised brain. So depression, sleep deprivation, that kind of thing. So if that's where you are, again, this is highly individualized, and I really recommend you talk to somebody like a dietitian or your physician about this if you decide to start supplementing. But that's where we see some benefit for the average woman thinking more clearly. We're not there yet.
Yeah, you,
that's what I mean.
You don't really understand supplements. You said something about, I want to make sure the supplement does something. That's not why. It's not why we're taking supplements. Take supplements because I don't want to do the other things that actually do something. I want to take this supplement instead. You clearly don't understand the point of supplements here, okay? Yeah. I live my life as this emoji. You can't see me right now, but it's like the shrugging, I'm not really sure hands emoji. Right. That's how I live most of my life. I think that's not true. But in this regard, it's like, hey, if you're lifting weights, like you said, give it a try, see if it helps. Keep tabs on your blood work and stuff. And if you're taking it and you want to take a flyer on there being a cognitive benefit that we don't know about yet that comes to light, I think you're not an insane person for taking that flyer on it, you know, like, but I just, if you're taking it as the savior, or if you, you know, the real issue with supplements is what I was joking about is when they are taken in lieu of more meaningful interventions. And so if this is like I'm going to take creatine instead of lift weights, that's backwards. If it's, I'm going to take creatine instead of my weekly cooking class for my cognition, it's like, that's backwards. So if it's on the pile, you know, if it's a pebble on the big rocks, I don't think I can voice a strong opposition.
Right. No, absolutely. And I absolutely know people who use it, again, like I said, for things like jet lag, sleep deprivation, and maybe there's some benefit there, but it's not something I generally recommend. There has to be a reason.
Cool. I want to be respectful of your time. I want to keep us
fine. I'm good.
Thank you. We'll move to our last. Oh no, we have two more topics. Let's talk about, let's talk about the medications that exist and who they're for and what somebody can hope for.
Yeah. So I always want to defer to my neurologist friends to be more specific about medications, but medications as it pertains specifically to Alzheimer's disease very much depends on what stage of the disease you're in. So some of the newer medications that are FDA approved are really for people who are at the earliest stages of Alzheimer's disease, diagnosed Alzheimer's disease. So they target beta amyloid plaques. Once you're a bit more advanced, there are a few medications that may slow the progression of disease, may help with memory somewhat, but it's kind of one of those things, like, for example, my mother is on one of them. You never know if without the medication, she would be at the same stage as where she is. But again, when it comes to the medications that we currently have, early intervention is essential in order to get the best possible outcome with medication. So again, the minute you start to suspect in a loved one or yourself that there might be some changes worth exploring, do that, because as terrifying as it is to go down that road, the possibility of delaying the disease is much stronger the earlier you get started.
Yeah. On that note, as being a family member of somebody and noticing something, I'd love to hear about your experience being your primary caregiver for your mother and just some of the things that you learned. And if there are people listening that are in this position or predict they'll be potentially in this position, what are some things that you think you could share with them that would be helpful?
Yeah. So I'm going to start just quickly with what I noticed in my mother, because if I had let my mother progress, I'm not sure like how long it would have taken for her to recognize that she had a problem. And this is pretty classic. What I noticed was her problem-solving skills. It wasn't necessarily her memory. It wasn't anything really dramatic. It was, my mother is a very intelligent woman, and I started to notice that her ability to solve problems that normally would be no issue for her, either she couldn't solve or she was solving very irrationally. So that was a really early hallmark of this disease, and I knew something was very wrong. I ultimately moved her in with me, and when I moved her in with me, I was able to get her to the doctor and we got her diagnosed. And in terms of caregiving, it really runs the gamut, because it depends on you know, how far along someone is and all the different situations that you have to deal with. And the disease progresses differently in different people. You know, fortunately, you know, something that is very common with Alzheimer's disease is people become very aggressive or their personality changes. And fortunately, that never happened with my mother. But it did get to the point, what I always said was, I will keep her at home with me unless it becomes unsafe for her. And unfortunately, it did. She started wandering out of the house in the middle of the night. So that was something that we couldn't, you know, we needed to move her into memory care. I will recommend two books that I find absolutely fantastic. One is The 36-Hour Day, which is a classic. It's been around forever and it's an amazing caregiver resource. The other is much newer, and that is Bruce Willis's wife, Emma Heming Willis, wrote a beautiful book that I highly recommend for caregivers everywhere of all different forms of dementia, not just Alzheimer's, both of these books. But you know, it and not everybody has the good fortune of being able to move their loved one in with them. I mean, some people have to go straight to long-term care. Something I would also say, and there is no shame in that. If that's what you have to do, that's what you have to do. I think a lot of people, unfortunately, a lot of caregivers, unfortunately, feel shame when they have to move their loved one into long-term care. One thing I would say for those of us who are healthy, a saving grace in this entire situation for me has been my mother's long-term care insurance. Without that, I don't know what I would be doing. Long-term memory care is incredibly expensive. And that is a piece of advice that I give to everyone. If you can find it and you can afford it, do it. Do it now. Start paying into it now, because it truly is the gift of a little less stress in a situation that is incredibly stressful. Just the financial burden of dementia is incredible.
No, I appreciate that insight, as I don't think that would be something that would have come across this conversation had you not had personal experience with that. So I appreciate
Right.
that. I think the first, it's funny because this is one of those things where it's something that somebody without Alzheimer's might do, but it was an indication for my grandmother when, you know, we speak Dutch, my family are from the Netherlands, most of them live there, and my aunt had messaged me on the side and said the last couple times you were FaceTiming Oma, is what we call grandma, that she had a bunch of post-it notes about everything about our lives on the computer, so, and that we couldn't see it. And she was like, "I think it's time." And that's what she had messaged me, and I was like, "I think it's time." And so that was like the last straw of at that point going to get more formal help. Ultimately, was lucky enough to move in with her daughter, my aunt, and so that was, like you said, nice. I'm not so sure what the imagining a better healthcare system than ours, but I don't know what that was like in terms of care for her ultimately by the end. But yeah. So I appreciate that.
And I mean, post-its, difficulty managing finances, that's something like missed bills, you know, for, you know, just not understanding how to pay their credit card, things like that are things that people don't generally think about when it comes to, you know, cognitive decline. But these are things that are extremely common. People, like, you notice somebody's like posting reminders or making lots of notes because they can't remember things.
What, wrapping up a bit, what did we miss that you maybe came here thinking, "Oh, I'd like to say that to, you know, before I go?"
I think we covered quite a lot. And I think it is, I mean, we didn't even talk about nutrition at all, but I think it is more important to talk about sort of because nutrition can be so nuanced. But I will just say a few things, because there is a little bit that we do know, you know, particularly from the MIND diet research, or MIND, Mediterranean Dash intervention for neurodegenerative delay, that eating in a pattern that is more plant forward, lower in saturated fat, not fat free, but lower in saturated fat, prioritizes omega-3 fatty acids, gets lots of fiber, leafy greens, lots of color. people who adhered to this dietary pattern specifically over 4.5 years had a 53% reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease. So that is something to note. And even people who adhered modestly had a 35% reduced risk. So what the way you eat does matter. We don't need to get crazy and we don't need to be super restrictive. And we certainly don't want to cause stress when it comes to our diet, but eat more greens. Eat some greens. Make sure you get some greens on your plate and lots of color. And then move your body. We didn't talk about sleep, but this is so incredibly important. Not only because it is just when your body sort of repairs itself in a general fashion, but it is when this lymphatic system kind of cleans out some of these proteins that can accumulate and it's kind of your brain's waste disposal system is deep sleep. And managing your stress, building cognitive reserve by using your brain and social connection. And then, something that is kind of corny, honestly, but really valid is having purpose and cultivating joy in your life. I mean, we're here to enjoy ourselves. And the more we can just have a reason for what we're doing and why we're here and to experience joy with other human beings, it goes a long way towards protecting ourselves because this disease is multifactorial. We don't know what causes it. So the more that we can do to just improve our lives in all these different kind of facets and ways, the more we can reduce our risk.
You can't tell obviously because you're sitting there, but you're speaking to a man who is pouring sweat out of most of the pores in his body that we recorded for an hour and 20 minutes. Didn't say one thing about sleep and nutrition. there's a health and fitness podcast. Like didn't say one thing about nutrition, but no, maybe it is because, even the diet you just laid out and it doesn't just because it's a thing that maybe people have heard before or know intellectually in their brain, it doesn't mean we shouldn't be underlining it, underscoring it, referencing it again and repeating it. And because this might be another reason to make that sort of a change that you didn't know about. But I guess there's a subconscious bias in me of like, the dietary habits that you just kind of laid out should be the foundation for your diet already, right? That if that was news that we should be eating more fiber and healthy fats, not too many saturated fats, all of that stuff. Yeah, that and sleep is important. But yeah, there are obviously two huge categories that impact a ton of different parts of your health, brain health being, notably one of them. But I'm just cracking up. You started talking and I was like, yeah, I'm sweating. Thank God you said that. You covered our butt there.
No. Yeah. And I mean, just the only other thing I want to just really be sure I absolutely highlight, because we already talked about type 3 diabetes being, just a misnomer. It's not an appropriate way to talk about Alzheimer's. And we also did briefly touch on LDL cholesterol. But even in my circles with the perimenopause and menopause, it is still very prevalent that there's this idea that people with high LDL cholesterol don't get Alzheimer's because it's protective. We need to eat more saturated fat and dietary cholesterol to protect our brain because our brain is primarily made of fat. I mean, no. No, we want to keep our LDL cholesterol, ApoB, nice and low, and saturated fat is not essential. Omega-3 fats are, omega-6 fats are, but omega-6 fats are easy to get. Let's prioritize getting more omega-3s.
You're saying just because cholesterol does something cool in the body, that doesn't mean that I should be just jacking that number up as high as possible. What a crazy thought. It's great. It's amazing. Yeah. Inspiring. Amazing. Barbie, I have to go. I hate that I'm cutting you off here. Such a good chat. You were wonderful. Absolutely love following you. You are a gem. Can you tell people where they can get more of you?
Well, sure. I am the Cognition Dietitian on Instagram. I also have a Substack called The Synapse. Those links are in my bio on Instagram. And then my website is barbiebowls.com. So everything is in one of those three places.
Cool. You got at least one new Substack subscriber today. So good job. Great. Good job.
Thank you so much, Jordan. And I love following you too. I love the comic relief. Oh my God. And you, I mean, you also provide amazing information, but you're incredible. No, you do. But you're incredible for comic relief. Your use of memes is genius.
Thank you so much. I got to get back on my meme game. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.